everyone who loves books. This is Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On Air, the show all about books that belongs to you. I'm your host, Red Sail, and this week, high seas adventurer Mick Dawson tells us all about the perils that faced him in becoming the first man to row the Pacific.
I estimated about 70 close encounters with all manner of species of whale.
Comedian Tony Hawks discusses the perils of moving to the West Country.
What soil do we need? How much water? When do we plant? Where do we plant? Do we need to put it in a greenhouse? When do you water it? How much do you water it?
Narrator David Monteith reveals a personal interest in the first book he read for the RNIB.
Obviously, growing up in Glasgow, I was very aware of the river, but my grandfather was a naval architect.
And the RNIB Connect Radio book group discusses a much-loved travelogue by Bill Bryson. That's all coming up in today's show. Mick Dawson is not a man to shy away from a challenge. The former Royal Marine Commando is a Guinness World Record holder for his rowing achievements. His latest and greatest adventure has just seen him complete one of the world's last great firsts, rowing across the Pacific Ocean. The 7,000-mile voyage took 3 attempts, during which he and rowing partner Chris Martin rowed round the clock and faced constant peril. His account of this epic adventure is retold in Rowing the Pacific, 7,000 miles from Japan to San Francisco. The book is out now, and Mick Dawson joined us to tell us all about it. Over to you, Robert.
Thanks, Red. Well, Mick, it was an incredible journey, 7,000 miles across the North Pacific to San Francisco from Japan. Now, the Pacific sounds like it should be, well, a very peaceful ocean, but we know from your book that it isn't.
The Pacific is probably not the worst, but certainly the least descriptive name of it. Having said that, on occasions it can be just the most placid place, but particularly the North Pacific, you're looking at a huge stretch of water, over 4,500 miles to the US, and it just brings consistent hostile elements to it. We were right the way through, even in the summer, dealing with storms up to 45 knots. And when we were racing into San Francisco towards the end in the winter, we were getting battered by storms that were getting longer, harsher, stronger, colder, and more frequent. Every 2 weeks, we expected to get at least one major low come through throughout. By the time we were getting into San Francisco, they were coming like with a day's break between them. Pacific is definitely not the word that would correctly describe that stretch of ocean most of the time.
And one thing people may wonder is why?
Why? Yeah. You know, when it all started, and I know some people will definitely understand this, maybe some people won't, but when people ask me, why do you want to row across, originally it was the Atlantic, my answer would be, why not? And it was as simple as that. As soon as I found out it was feasible, I couldn't work out why more people weren't doing it. It flicked a switch for me, and it was just the right thing to do. But I have to say, having gone through 10 years of ultimately 5 different ocean rows and then sitting down and having to analyse it right in the book, I started to ask myself that question in a bit more depth. And during the book, came up with a few more answers. But, obviously, the part of it is your character and your upbringing and your background. I tried to answer that question more in the book and probably answered it for myself as much as anything. I started that book thinking, why not? And by the end of it, I'd kind of realised that, you know, there were things in my life that had led me down that path and made rowing, particularly the North Pacific, a requirement.
And how's your relationship with your rowing partner, Chris Martin?
It's amazingly really good. That's why we were successful. We got on. We never argued. We had times when we didn't want to talk to each other and probably were getting on each other's nerves, me more on Chris's nerves than him on mine. But that was the secret. We were a brilliant partnership. I mean, that's what came out of it for me. I'm more proud about the fact that we became that team achieve what we did than what we actually achieved. It was, you know, it was a, you know, getting to San Francisco was just a natural byproduct of how good we were as a team. So that was a real achievement. But yeah, we're good mates. He's just had his second child. He married his then girlfriend Sandra, and he organises races from rowing races from California to Hawaii now. I'm not allowed to go to the start in case I get on a boat if anybody gets off. So we're still good mates. You couldn't do something like that and not have a special bond with somebody.
For people that can't see, can you describe the boat for us?
Absolutely. My first boat, when I was doing the initial Atlantic race with my brother and then the solo Pacific attempt, the boat that I lost was basically a kit. It came in plywood board that we put together, built, and it was like a tank. But the boat that I built for the North Pacific row that Chris and I did was like it was like going from the Sopwith Camel to a jet fighter. It's a phenomenal piece of kit. It was sleek, blue and silver, cabin at the back, small cabin at the front, a rowing deck in the middle. She looked fantastic, and she was built specifically for that job. 50 kilos of lead in the keel, so that she, if she went over, she would definitely come back up. And she was made out of a foam sandwich of Kevlar carbon, so she was light but incredibly strong. And she looked, it's like looking at Concorde in ocean rowing boat terms to your first commercial airliner. I love my first boat, but the Bojangles, the boat that we went across the Pacific on, looked and was the part.
Now, you said if it went over, were there any times it was close to going over?
Strangely enough, we were knocked down twice, as I recall. I was on deck once and we got knocked down. On any other boat, we would have gone over. But she was so good, and that additional weight on the keel and the way we stowed her and the profile, she never went over. She's really rigid. I'm sure some of your listeners will be sailors. You'll know what I mean when I say a stiff boat. She was stiff when the waves hit her, and quite rigid. And she was really resistant to going over, so she never capsized. And you wouldn't believe the conditions we were in at times. Throughout that trip, but she got knocked over right on her beam end twice, and she still wouldn't go over. She just popped back up again. So, she was and still is the best ocean rowing boat that's ever been built for the job of getting across the North Pacific.
Now, recently on the show, we had someone who is not as big a journey as yours, but they kayaked around Ireland, and they commented on how much wilderness and how much wildlife there was out there. Any close encounters?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's a big trip in a kayak around Ireland. That's a bucket list trip for kayakers. That's really why I went back. The North Pacific was just the most incredible environment for wildlife. And I got, I think when I went across solo and capsized after 109 days, I had encountered, I estimated, about 70 close encounters with all manner of species of whale. And that's from killer whales, pod of killer whales that effectively adopted me. I mean, regularly came to visit me. Sei whales, right whales, fin whales, pilot whales, to even one day paddling along or rowing along next to a blue whale for what must have been nearly an hour. I think it was just drifting in as it was sleeping. But it's just the most, a blue whale doesn't even look like a whale. It's so big. It looks like a different species of animal. But it was just teeming with wildlife on the North Pacific, and so remote, you're so isolated, it's like being on another planet. That was the reason I went back. When I lost the film when I capsized in 2004 on my own, and I wanted to go back and get that story again, which is what Chris and I did.
You must have felt so small next to that whale.
Yeah, well, I'll be honest, the blue whale was surreal. I felt smaller when the killer whales were charging at the boat to come and have a look at me, and slightly more vulnerable. I think I've been at sea something like 420 days in ocean rowing boats on the Atlantic and the Pacific, and everyone talks about whales hitting you. The only contact I've ever made with a whale was on the 2009 trip when three of them came to play with us for about 6 hours, and I managed to row onto the back of one by mistake. And even then, it didn't react violently. It just dropped down and left us alone. Just going out on the ocean, I think, on any boat, gives you your place in the universe. you know, any ego disappears straight away. If it doesn't, it should do.
Fantastic. Now, just finally, how do you handle the mundane things like sleep?
It's not mundane. It's the most precious thing on an ocean rowing boat. When we were together all my double rows, we basically did 2 hours on, 2 hours off, round the clock, and we were religious on that. Chris and I worked out that we probably didn't row in 6.5 months at sea for maybe 12 hours when we could have in that whole voyage. That's how relentless we were to keeping that boat moving towards America, because it was a desperate battle to get in time. So 2 hours on, 2 hours off, 24 hours a day. The only variation to that was, and service personnel amongst your listeners will know, dog watch, which is 6 to 8. We'd make those 1 hour watches so that you didn't do the same shift every day. You basically reverse the shifts. In fact, one day you'd do 11 hours, the other day you'd do 13. So we came to regard the 11 hour day as our day off. So every other day was a day off.
Now, talking of service personnel, you've done some work with Blind Veterans UK.
Well, I've got some friends at Blind Veterans UK. Yeah, I'm hoping to do some more stuff with them. A couple of guys I serve with, Reggie Perrin, who I joined the Marines with, and Marine Sparks, Marine Sparks, that ex-Marine. He was in my brother's troop in training. I met him the other day, actually, for the first time in years. So, yeah, I'd very much like to. I'm very local. I'm just up the road, so I'd very much like to do more work with them. And I'm hoping, especially with the release of the audio book, that this will be something that can link me with them.
Who's actually reading the audio book?
Well, this may be quite alarming to people listening to this interview, but me.
Have you done it already?
I did it. Yeah, I went up to London. My publisher initially said to me, "I'll send you some tapes," and I said, "Well, no, this is my story. This is a very personal story. It's my story. Until I prove I'm completely incompetent, I want to be the first refusal." And so they gave me 5 days at the studio to get it done, and I got it done in 2.5. So I'm hoping that's a good time. So, yeah, it's been released, and it's my narration. So, yeah, it's my story and my words, which I'm really, I hope people enjoy it, but I'm really pleased that I'm able to do that.
Thanks to Robert, and hats off to Mick Dawson. And if you're listening live or have been very quick off the mark in downloading the podcast, the print and audio versions of Rowing the Pacific, 7,000 miles from Japan to San Francisco, were first released yesterday and are available wherever books are sold. The talking book is also available from the RNIB library.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in both Braille and giant print, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
Hello, I'm Ray Sawyer. I've been reading for the RNIB Talking Books for 25 years now. My first book was Coming From Behind by Howard Jacobson, but the one I think I enjoyed most was Writing Home by Alan Bennett. Not just because it's wonderful writing, but although not officially an autobiography, you got a sense of his life as all his selections of writings were put in chronological order. I particularly like The Lady in the Van. The Talking Book studios, as now, were very close to where Alan Bennett lived, and I was able to walk up and actually see the driveway in the house in which the lady lived for 25 years. And quite by chance, Alan Bennett was sitting on his front step reading The Guardian when I turned up.
This van, there were to be 3 others in the course of the next 20 years, was originally brown. But by the time it had reached the Crescent, it had been given a coat of yellow. Miss S. was fond of yellow. It's the papal colour, and was never content to leave her vehicles long in their original trim. Sooner or later she could be seen moving slowly round her immobile home, thoughtfully touching up the rust from a tiny tin of primrose paint, looking, in her long dress and sun hat, much as Vanessa Bell would have looked had she gone in for painting Bedford vans. Miss S. never appreciated the difference between car enamel and ordinary gloss paint, and even this she never bothered to mix. The result was that all her vehicles ended up looking as if they'd been given a coat of badly made custard or plastered with scrambled egg. Still, there were few occasions on which one saw Miss Shepherd genuinely happy, and one of them was when she was putting paint on.
I love doing the talking books because, you get to play parts that you'd never get to play in real life. In fact, doing a book is a bit like doing a one-man show, only one that's 25 hours long.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come on this week's show, Tony Hawkes discusses Devon and Bingo, and the RNIB Connect Radio book group reflect on an American's views of Britain. But first, it's always a pleasure to meet the narrators who bring books to life for us. And because RNIB Connect Radio's London studio is in the same building as the Talking Books studio, I get plenty of opportunity. This week, when a familiar voice offered to help me clear up the tea I'd just spilt, I leapt at the chance to invite David Monteith onto the show. I began by asking him which book he's recording at the moment.
A biography of Keir Hardie.
Any good?
It's very good. It's very interesting. It's always fascinating to read about the history and the founding of the Labour Party, where it came from, a lot about the founding principles and about the man himself.
He had quite a hard life, didn't he?
He did. He was a miner. He was born to a very poor family. I think he was the eldest of five or six, and I'm going back 3 days now, and I can't always remember what I read on Friday. But certainly one of possibly two of his siblings died when very young. So he was part of a very large family. He recounts a story about being sacked when he worked for a bakery, for a baker's, a very wealthy baker's. And because his father was away looking for work, his father was a ship's carpenter, he was away looking for work. His mother was ill, and so young Keir was the only breadwinner. Because he was working so hard, the weather was dreadful, he turned up late for work, 15 minutes late. He was told by the girl he was working for, under the auspices of this much richer baker, he was told by her that if he was late again, he would be in serious trouble. Unfortunately, the next day he was also 15 minutes late. This was the second day he was late, was his payday. He turned up at work, hoping that everything would be well, was instructed to go and visit the senior employer, the very wealthy man who was sitting at this massive breakfast table with his entire family assembled. Young Keir was soaked to the skin, barefoot, basically rags, you know, the archetypal, stereotypical urchin. He was told that he had brought the bakery into disrepute and that people to whom he was supposed to be delivering were going to leave the bakery because they weren't getting their morning rolls when still hot. So he was sacked. Not only was he sacked, he was fined the previous week's wages. So lost his job, was sent home to an ill mother with nothing but the girl who had chastised him the day before gave him a single roll. He knew of what he spoke when he was founding the
yes.
party.
The social injustice really sort of...
Absolutely.
And he worked in the mines as well, didn't he, for a bit?
He did for... Again, it's jumping quite a lot back in the story, and I've gone beyond there, but I think he was in the mines for about 15 years.
Gosh, a hard life as well, but one that led him to become a union representative and led to his political career.
Absolutely. And interestingly, for somebody who was born in Scotland and sort of lived a lot of his life in Scotland, he was an MP in England and in Wales, but never in Scotland.
Oh, how funny. I never realised that. I wonder what he would have thought of Jeremy Corbyn. I mean, Keir Hardie was the man who suggested state socialism at the beginning of the 20th century.
Yes, indeed. I suspect he would have seen eye to eye with Mr. Corbyn on many things. he said, treading a middle ground.
Well, maybe not appearing at Glastonbury, but...
Well, Keir Hardie certainly appeared at many conferences and events and meetings. I guess part of what he would say is any way you can get the message out and across to people is worthwhile.
Yeah, absolutely. I was looking down the list of talking books that you've narrated for the RNIB library, and you're quite a one for taking the renegade characters, aren't you? Especially the Scots.
Well, that's just, I'm Scots, and that's where I'm from, that's where my accent naturally lends itself to, and that's the nature of the books I'm offered.
Did you enjoy reading, I think it was Renegade by Robin Young, the Robert the Bruce book?
I did. Obviously, that was based on fact. There was a lot of interesting story woven around that to tie lots of things together. But yeah, it's a great book. Massively difficult in one respect, in that before one of the huge battles, there were a huge number. There were, from memory, I think it was about 30 young Scottish noblemen all talking to each other, all discussing the battle, which made the vocal transition, from the voiceover point of view, made the vocal transition from one character to another, working out who was speaking when it didn't necessarily say, you know, said John, said Robert, said Dugald, made it very complicated. But it was a fantastic read. Great story.
How do you go about preparing that? Do you have coloured markers or...?
Yes, I normally read from an iPad, and there's a piece of software called iAnnotate. So I'm usually set, not so much with RNIB books, they tend to be paper, but for commercial books, they are almost always PDF format. I get them and I very simply read the book and then read it again, highlighting dialogue and working out which a colour coding for each character, so that I know when I do a quick glance down the page that the hero is about to turn up. So it's just it allows me a couple of seconds just to be aware that I'm going to have to do a vocal change.
So in some ways, not only are you the complete cast of actors, but you are also the director as well.
In many respects, yes, because I'm making the decision about how a line comes out. Sometimes it's not necessarily a conscious decision, it just presents itself. You happen to say something with a particular emphasis that you may not even have considered when you were reading it.
And what led you to the RNIB Talking Books Library in the first place?
I was offered a book. It was that simple. I spent years as I still am, a commercial voiceover. Mm-hmm. I do an awful lot of work on film and television. One of the commercial publishers approached me about doing a book. I happened to end up doing it here. Would I be interested in reading for RNIB? And I said, absolutely, yes, of course.
Quite a lot of tartan noir.
Yes, I do an awful lot of Scottish crime.
You don't strike me as a particularly threatening man, but do you have a rasping burr to your voice for which you
There
say-
is a certain pitch I can get to if I really need to.
I'm scared now.
He lied through his teeth.
I recognised that from, I think you did an Inspector Rebus, didn't you? A Question
yes,
of Blood.
Yes, I did.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's your chilling voice.
Well, it's one of them. It's like, I suppose it's, what's a good, like being a musician. You have certain tunes that you can fall back on that you know are going to be popular. And sometimes you have to just use them to allow the story to roll on. Mm-hmm. And you get to do maybe slightly more adventurous stuff with incidental characters. It can be very, vocally, very tiring to do too rough and deep and gravelly a voice for an entire book.
Mm.
So my Scots heroes tend to have, as I do, light Glasgow accent, slightly heavier than the one that I normally speak with, because my voice is narrator voice, and then you have what I think of as hero voice, which is or anti-hero voice, which is the one that I go to most easily, the one that I can get to at any point.
I also noticed that you have rather a nice hero in The Nicest Viking.
That was an absolute joy. They were great. I love reading kids' books. I used to read to my own kids before they got to an age where they went, Dad, stop reading to us. It's boring.
And, well, a book that you read that is very real and that I enjoyed dipping in and out of because it was a world I knew nothing about was Song to the Clyde, a history of shipbuilding on the Clyde.
That was quite a personal one. Obviously, growing up in Glasgow, I was very aware of the river, but my grandfather was a naval architect. He designed submarines in the 1930s. So when I saw it sitting on the shelf, I said to Rupert, if when you were considering casting that, you might consider me, I would be eternally grateful.
Oh, it's a wonderful collection of stories and anecdotes and insights into... Well, a world that's gone. I mean, not only are the ships' names forgotten, but so are the names of the people who worked there.
Indeed. And the number of shipyards. I mean, I remember about four names growing up in Glasgow in the 60s and 70s. There were, I mean, obviously more than that. There were yards that weren't the huge commercial yards that we think of today. My grandfather worked in Yarrow's, there were John Brown's, there were, you know, a few others dotted about the Clyde. But from the book, I learnt about the literally hundreds, if not thousands, of shipyards that there had been, and not just on the Clyde, which, you know, obviously the main river going through Glasgow, but on all the tributary rivers and even the canals, there were bona fide, proper shipyards making narrow boats or canal boats or structures that were then used, transported down those canals to the big major yards. So it's a fascinating process.
And do you often find yourself really engaged with the books that you read?
I think you have to be, because you're trying to express the story. And you always have to remember that it is, generally speaking, it is a story rather than a biography. As the narrator or the reader, you have to be committed to the point of view or the course of action that any character you're reading about is going through at that time. Be that something, you know, wonderful, a celebration or, you know, massive love story or whatever, you have to buy into that with the same degree of enthusiasm as you have to buy into being the murderer in a rebus. It has to be from the point of view of the character at the moment you're reading it, because that's, in theory, what I'm providing to the listener.
Thanks to David, and we'll be hearing more from him later in the show. For a full list of titles that he's narrated, just go to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999 and select option 5.
Love books? Well, RNIB Library has a world of books and loads more reading for you to enjoy. And you can choose from Braille, giant print and talking books. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999. RNIB Library, here for all your reading needs.
You're listening to Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio. Coming up soon, Tony Hawks discusses his move to the Wild West Country. But before that, did you know that there's a book group that meets regularly on RNIB Connect Radio? Recently, they discussed Bill Bryson's Notes from a Small Island. Later, we'll be telling you how you can get involved. But first, let's hear what they had to say.
The parks used to be described on maps as the Upper Pleasure Gardens and Lower Pleasure Gardens. But some councillor or other force for good realized the profound and unhealthy implications of placing lower and pleasure in such immediate proximity, and successfully lobbied to have lower removed from the title. So now you have the Upper Pleasure Gardens and the Mere Pleasure Gardens, and lexical perverts have been banished to the beaches, where they must find such gratification as they can by rubbing themselves on the groins. Anyway, that's the kind of place Bournemouth is, genteel to a fault and proud of it.
Alan, what were your thoughts?
I, like David, read the book some years ago,
and at that time I enjoyed the read, and I approached it with an open mind. I did enjoy it more than I thought I would second time round. I found it a bit dated because, I mean, he started, you know, on the Kent coast in 1973, which obviously, and he mentions language and, you know, English phrases like counterpane. And I don't use, I mean, I haven't heard the term counterpane for
a child.
Yes, exactly. So it was dated in that sense. What I liked about it, I mean, I've read a lot of Bryson. I'm almost overdosed on him, really. And I don't want this to sound churlish, but I'm almost grown out of him, if you like, and moved on to perhaps more serious travel writers like Paul Theroux, who I absolutely love, you know, because he deals with culture, he deals much more in depth. It's a much more serious read. Plus, there's this understated humour that he brings to play as well, quite political. So I think for the right time, I actually did enjoy it. And what it did for me, I mean, you know, there's two places he talked about in quite in length that I've never visited. One, from reading his account, I want to visit, like, tomorrow. I can't wait to go to Durham and visit Durham Cathedral. And visit, I've got a friend who's got a daughter at the university there, so I might accompany my friend when he visits his daughter and look, have a good look round Durham, because it sounds wonderful, Durham as a town.
I was heading for Newcastle by way of York when I did another impetuous thing. I got off at Durham, intending to poke around the cathedral for an hour or so, and fell in love with it instantly in a serious way. Why, it's wonderful. A perfect little city. And I kept thinking, why did no one tell me about this? I knew, of course, that it had a fine Norman cathedral, but I had no idea that it was so splendid. I couldn't believe that not once in 20 years had anyone said to me, you've never been to Durham? Good God, man, you must go there at once. Please, take my car.
He really didn't like Blackpool very much. And you don't go to Blackpool to find the meaning of life. You go to Blackpool for what it is. It's just a fun thing, you know, and lots of people go there. And he gave some really interesting stats, actually, about how many visitors Blackpool get.
Yeah,
compared
I couldn't
to
believe that.
No, I couldn't believe it, Sabrina. No, I couldn't believe it. Mm. And I found that interesting, you know, apart from anything, it's a good sort of conversation starter when you're talking about travelling. But it's always been my ambition, sometime before I leave this world, to walk from Land's End to John O'Groats, unaccompanied or accompanied, probably now because of sight, accompanied. And I was really disappointed with John O'Groats, the way he described John O'Groats. I mean, I don't know if Peggy knows John O'Groats, but, you know, like Land's End, is very, you know, underwhelming as well. And it seems to me we don't make enough of the two extremities of these islands, you know, and he was disappointed with John O'Groats. I mean, he went, I think, off season, so there was only one shop open, and there was only one shop there, apparently. You know, I wouldn't visit Blackpool if I read that, his account of it, if I took it as his opinion, and I probably wouldn't be over keen to go out of my way to go to John O'Groats now. And Durham was the opposite. The way he described Durham was, I can't wait to go to Durham, especially to go to the cathedral there, which he described very well.
Well, I have been, and I recommend it highly. It's a wonderful
place. Yeah,
yes, definitely.
Yeah, and I agree with you about Chester, and I'm not just saying that because you're from Chester. I've heard so many good reports. I stayed at the university in the halls of residence once on a conference and didn't really get a chance to visit the town and the terrace streets and the beamed buildings, but he could have visited Chester. London goes without saying. I mean, I love London more than any place I've ever visited in the world, and I've been, you know, to many major cities in the world, in particular the Far East. But London, to me, it has everything. You can get any book you want. You can eat any food you want. You can find anything if you know where to go in London. And to me, that's an earth shrinker, especially if you're visually impaired. Actually, I mean, you know, if you know someone who knows London well off the tourist beat as well, the world is literally your oyster in London. It has a lot of things against it.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, I think, yeah. So he didn't have to tell me that. But his humour, if you read a lot, and it sounds like you're going to, this was your first experience of Bryson. Yeah, he sometimes, I agree with someone said, you know, you're not sure whether, I think David said, you're not sure whether it's tongue-in-cheek or he's trying to make a salient point, a point that someone travelling or coming through the town or city would take seriously. Not always abundantly clear, his humour. Mm. And I think to answer your question, Tom, about why does it take an American, I mean, he lived in Yorkshire for some time anyway, so he's quite anglicised that way. But I think he has that detachment. You know, it's like you doing a review on New York. You know, we would probably see New York very differently to people who live in the suburbs of New York. So I think he gives him licence to be sometimes overcritical and sometimes bland, but he's been very selective. It's not a tour, you know, of every major city or historic or otherwise. So I don't want people to pick the book to listen to and think, you know, this is going to tell me about every place of interest in the British Isles, because clearly it's not. But I enjoyed it, and I think the biggest compliment I can pay it, I'd like to read this sequel he's written, almost Notes from a Small Island Revisited. I think it's called something, A Road to Dribble or something.
A Road to Little Dribbling.
I now want to read that. So, I mean, that's the biggest compliment I can pay it, really.
It's in the R&IB New Books, the latest New Books
list. Yes, it
is, yeah. Is it? Oh, that's timely.
I was just going to say that I wasn't able to read much of the book, but what I read, I was able to, you know, I thoroughly enjoyed. I love his sort of writing style and the fact that he sort of, I think the fact that his observations are sort of so humorous as well. I sort of definitely want to read more of his writing.
Mm. Well, there's plenty to read.
There's absolutely loads. My favourite book of his was a book called A Short History of Nearly Everything.
Yeah.
A very optimistic title. But it actually encourages, and for somebody like me, I'm interested in science without being a scientist. So what it actually did for me was it encouraged me to read around various topics that he raised. It kind of starts off with the beginning of the universe and comes right through to modern times. I mean, it's, you know, very thumbnail sketches. Of events and things that happen, but it just does encourage you to sort of read around various subjects, and that's where I think Bill Bryson's at his best. He actually, you take him as a starting point, and then you carry on. If any particular subject that he discusses takes your fancy, then you can do some reading around it.
Yeah, I read that book for another book group, actually. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Very factual. So, you know, you have to reread certain things to remember it, but it's a very, very good book.
Clearly a bit of a hit. Bill Bryson's Notes from a Small Island is available from the R&IB Library in giant print, braille, and as TB 10500. And if you'd like to get involved in an R&IB book group, here's how.
R&IB. Supporting people with sight loss.
Would you like to chat over the telephone with a group of like-minded people? RNIB's award-winning telephone social groups are small, friendly and lots of fun. A great way of making new friends and a chance to socialise without leaving the comfort of your home. To join, telephone RNIB Talk and Support on 0845 330 3723 or email talkandsupport@rnib.org.uk. RNIB is a membership organisation. To join, visit rnib.org.uk/membership.
Now, while we're on the subject of quirky views of Britain, Tony Hawks has travelled round Ireland with a fridge, played the Moldovans at tennis, and successfully transported a piano to the Pyrenees. But he may have met his match with his recent move to Devon, as Robert Kirkwood found out.
Our quest began in the nursery. We were lucky enough to have one close by, the kind that dealt in plants rather than fledgling humans. So while Fran prepared lunch, I drove down there to begin this epic and heroic quest. An initial foray before we took it on together. I walked past greenhouses containing a host of plants and flowers that I couldn't begin to name, and into the small shop that was in the corner of the nursery's plot. Behind the counter, a meek-looking man awaited me, like a character in a TV sketch show waiting for the action to begin.
Tony Hawk's reading from his new book, Once Upon a Time in the West Country. At I Write Glasgow's Book Festival, I asked him about the book.
The new book's all about a massive change in my life. I was living in London with my partner Fran, and we decided to go on holiday to the Philippines, where her mother's from the Philippines, so she's half Filipino, half English. And we were exploring that amazing country. And then one night I sat up, bolt upright in the middle of the night, and said, we don't need to live in London anymore. And we discussed it at breakfast, and we realised that we'd started to live a life where there was no community, and we wanted to go somewhere where we knew people and we contributed, and we went to stay with friends in Devon and started looking around and fell in love with Devon, really, and then found this little house, bought it, and took the plunge and moved completely from the middle of the city, really, or big city, down to the middle of nowhere. The book is kind of like half a diary of this, what happens when you do this. And I suppose there's another big section, which is a bit like Round Island with a Fridge in the middle, where I cycle coast to coast with a pig. So there's a wacky adventure in the middle as well.
The last time we read one of your books, you were on the balcony in your house in the Pyrenees. Do you still have that house?
I do. And currently there's there's someone lodging there, got a lodger in, and it's partly because now we've moved to Devon, we realise that house is sort of offering much the same. It used to be a brilliant place to escape London and with beautiful views. Well, now we live in a place like that, albeit without snow-capped mountains. But I still love going to France. We haven't quite decided what to do with it. I might sell it, or I really need to win Fran over to love it as much as I do. I really love it, but she's not so keen.
What group of locals were better to get along with?
That's an interesting one. I mean, it was actually well accepted with both. The French, I think, accepted me because I went to all the social events and drank a lot of wine and bumbled through in French, made great efforts.
Apart from the bingo.
Well, I've had the bingo experience in both books because I was asked to read the bingo for the village hall in Devon, in the village in Devon. And I've really laid into bingo in this book now, having now gone once as a punter in France and thought it was a terrible idea, and then once actually then having to call the bingo, because that's what they got me to do. There's no greater torture. That's worse than waterboarding, really. If they want to get anything out of anyone, just get them to call bingo for an evening. That would do it.
I said hello, quickly getting the niceties out of the way, and then began to subject him to a barrage of questions. What soil do we need? How much water? When do we plant? Where do we plant? Do we need to put it in a greenhouse? When do you water it? How much do you water it? Is it best to wear tracksuit bottoms? Are platform shoes a no-no? Nurseryman answered each of my questions with great patience and diligence, but by the time I'd finished, his expression had changed from buoyant and dynamic to browbeaten and deflated, as if someone had hit him quite hard in the stomach.
Now, since your book set in Moldova, you've been involved in various philanthropic activities out there. How are they still going?
Going well, actually. We've now opened a much bigger, brand-new centre that we've built from scratch. They've renamed it the Tony Hawk Centre. It was the Hippocrates Centre. But they reckon they can get more PR if they use my name to get more funding. And the work is good. I went over for the opening in September. We nearly had the Prime Minister of Moldova there. He dropped out the day before. That was a big disappointment, actually. But it shows that there's much more interest in it than there's ever been before. And I'm hopeful that we can go out later this year and have another visit, see what's being done there. But it's great. It really is a great facility and helping lots of kids with cerebral palsy, and teaches the mothers and the parents how to do various treatments as well. So it's really progressive ideas.
It was a really touching scene at the end of the movie where you showed the centre.
Yeah, that's right. And those kids that are in the movie, they've all been going to the centre for ages. And Yeah, I'm glad you found it touching. It's a nice, I think it's a nice story, yeah.
Now, back to your new book. How did the travel with Titch come around?
I was playing the Moldovan tennis film at a little village hall in Skoriton, and because we hit the big time. But it was packed. It was packed, so it was good. So we had a good atmosphere, and there was a question and answer session at the end. This woman put her hand up and said, she said, "I bet, are you taking any more wacky bets?" And I said, "No, I'm pretty much retired from that." And she said, "Well, I've got a bet for you." She didn't even listen to my answer. She said, "I bet you can't walk round Devon with my pet pig, Dave." So I kind of dismissed this idea, thought it was a bit silly, but it stuck at the back of my mind. And then 6 months later, I needed to raise some money for the care centre. And I thought, well, I've done all these wacky things like hitching with fridges, playing Moldovans at tennis. I've never done anything where I've actually got some sponsors. Mm-hmm. So why don't I do something silly and this time get some sponsors and then we can raise money for the care centre. So I thought maybe I'll do the pig thing. Tried to get in touch with this woman, couldn't find her anywhere. But somebody said, actually, you'd never be able to do it anyway, a pig... It's called pig-headed for a reason. You know, if they're stubborn, they don't want to do it. You'll never budge a 200-pound pig with a lead round it. You'd get nowhere. And then someone else suggested that I get a baby micro pig. There's a little farm in Devon called Pennywell Farm where they breed these. So I pitched up there, said, could I borrow a pig for a week? They said yes. So I was united with this beautiful little baby pig called Titch, 3 months old, tiny little thing, put it in a pouch, and then I cycled from coast to coast in Devon, and so that's how that came about.
And you're keeping fit out there with a swimming harness?
Oh, yes, the Hawk's harness. Yeah, this is, I'm really pleased, this is my invention. I suppose you'd have to read the book to find out this, but most people are very sceptical of this idea that I put this sort of belt round me, attach myself to a rope with a chest expander in there as well for a bit of give, and I can swim on the spot in a tiny little sort of plunge pool or a paddling pool almost. And Ken, my neighbour, had great faith in this, and it does work amazingly, the Hawk's harness. But I've not patented it. I'm very much like Tim Berners-Lee. I've given it to the world.
Now, you said you've recorded the audio version of your latest book. Is it important that your books are available in audio and in Braille?
It is, actually, because I'm a big supporter of the RNIB, and so we were saying before we started this interview, I always admire the courage of blind people to go about life almost as normal. I see them moving around the place, I think, wow. And I've tried to do that. I've tried to shut my eyes and move across a room, and... I get quite frightened. So I've always wanted to support and help, and I think, in a way, you know, I never get the say in this, but if I was ever a really powerful author, I'd say that these talking books should be given free to blind people.
Knowing that I'd return with Fran at a later date, I then scoured the shelves and returned with the rather pathetic haul of one tray of lettuce seedlings. As I faced nurseryman over the counter, I realised that this wouldn't represent a fair remuneration for what I'd just inflicted on the fellow. I quickly grabbed some gardening gloves for Fran. The man looked at me with an element of incredulity. "We'll use them for gardening," I said, as he put the cash in the till. He needed reassurance.
Tony Hawk's reading from his book Once Upon a Time in the West Country, available commercially in print, ebook, and audio. From RNIB Talking Books and RNIB Overdrive, you can listen to Round Ireland with a Fridge, TB number 13500. Playing the Moldovans at Tennis, TB 20094. And One Hit Wonderland, TB 13249. And for more information, head to rnib.org.uk.
Thanks to Robert and to Tony Hawks, whose books never fail to give me fits of the giggles. Do you have a favourite author or book that you'd like us to feature on the show? Or maybe you found a hidden gem in the library that you'd like to share? Drop us a line by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
The RNIB Helpline is your direct line to the support and advice you need. Whatever your inquiry, the RNIB Helpline team are only a call away with practical and emotional support so you can face the future with confidence. Our friendly, specially trained operators are just a phone call away from 8:45 a.m. and to 5:30 p.m. every weekday. We can help with information on everything you need to know about the RNIB, from eye health, advice on how to volunteer, reading services and loads more, or we can simply offer a listening ear. The RNIB Helpline, here for you on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
This is an RNIB talking book.
History of the Talking Book Service and Studios. The Second World War caused a metal shortage, which had an unexpected effect for Talking Books listeners.
The American Foundation for the Blind sent us a gift of 500,000 gramophone needles. And of course, needles became blunt. If you don't have needles to play these gramophone records, you just couldn't hear them, basically. So the blunter the needles became, the worse the sound became. So we needed new needles to keep the thing going.
Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service, offering books in audio, braille and giant print, along with many other benefits such as braille music scores, giant print sheet music, online forums and much more. Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Now it's back to David Monteith for the books of his life. So I'm delighted to be joined today by David Monteith, who is an RNIB narrator, and he's taken time out in between recordings to come in and talk to me about the books of his life. So David, welcome to Read On Air. And is there a book that you read as a child or young man that gave you a love of reading?
I think probably the first book I remember would have been raiding my dad's bookshelves for James Bond novels. I don't quite know why I gravitated to those, maybe because I'd seen the films, but they were fun, they were exciting, they were very pacey, and they were something I could associate with films that I had already seen. So people often talk about that pivotal moment of you find a book or a style or a genre that never particularly leaves you, although it may change, but it's the thing that engenders just a love of words and reading. As daft as it may sound, it would have to be the Bond novels.
The scent and smoke and sweat of a casino are nauseating at 3 a.m. Then the soul erosion produced by high gambling, a compost of greed and fear and nervous tension, becomes unbearable, and the senses awake and revolt from it. James Bond suddenly knew that he was tired. He always knew when his body or his mind had had enough, and he always acted on the knowledge. This helped him to avoid staleness and the sensual bluntness that breeds mistakes. He shifted himself unobtrusively away from the roulette he had been playing, and went to stand for a moment at the brass rail which surrounded breast-high the top table in the salle privée. Le Chiffre was still playing and still apparently winning. There was an untidy pile of flecked 100-meal plaques in front of him. In the shadow of his thick left arm there nestled a discreet stack of the big yellow ones worth 500,000 francs each. Bond watched the curious, impressive profile for a time, and then he shrugged his shoulders to lighten his thoughts and moved away.
And a book that you curl up with on a rainy day and reread with great pleasure?
Lord of the Rings. It has to be a very, very long rainy day, though.
To say.
But yeah, I can dip into Lord of the Rings at any point, and I've read it so many times now. I borrowed it from my school library aged 13. Hope I returned it. Still, I've got other copies anyway, but I've read it so many times that I can drop into it and just enjoy it from whatever point.
Frodo woke and found himself lying in bed. At first he thought that he had slept late after a long unpleasant dream that still hovered on the edge of memory. Or perhaps he had been ill. But the ceiling looked strange. was flat, and it had dark beams richly carved. He lay a little while longer, looking at patches of sunlight on the wall, and listening to the sound of a waterfall. "Where am I? And what is the time?" he said aloud to the ceiling. "In the house of Elrond, and it is 10 o'clock in the morning," said a voice. "It is the morning of October the 24th, if you want to know." "Gandalf!" cried Frodo, sitting up. There was the old wizard, sitting in a chair by the open window. "Yes," he said, "I'm here. And you were lucky to be here too, after all the absurd things you have done since you left home."
And finally, a book that you've read recently that's resonated with you and that you'd like to share with the listeners.
Super Proud Project. Just an absolute romp. Three kids. A young adult book. Huge fun. Good villains. Old enough that teenagers would enjoy it, but with enough fantasy that that younger kids would go for it as well.
The Superpower Project by Paul Bristow. Chapter 1. Up and Down. There was something strange about the way Megan's gran had exploded. The strangeness wasn't that she was on holiday at the time. It wasn't that it was particularly unlucky, because she had won the holiday in a competition. It wasn't even that she was water skiing when it happened. No, it was that before exploding on faulty water skis on her unexpected holiday, she had not phoned Megan when she said she would. Gran always phoned. Always.
David Monteith, thank you so much for sharing your obvious love of reading with us on Read On Air, and carry on the good work.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again to David. And don't forget, if you'd like to share the books of your life, drop us a line by emailing the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. So that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to Mick, David, Tony and the RNIB Connect Radio Book Group. And to everyone who's been in touch about your book groups, the titles you've been enjoying, and your ideas for books that I should read. Read On Air will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, packed with book news, reviews, and author interviews. Simply go to audioboom.com and search for RNIB, where you'll find Read On Air and other great content from RNIB Connect Radio. So, until next week, thanks for listening, and remember to read on.